Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the ambitious to-do list the Republican Congress has, with plans to hit the ground running early next year and actually make House members work Monday through Friday instead of the three-day week that they are used to, enacting an aggressive agenda to overturn Obama's rules and programs by repealing a host of regulations at once instead of one at a time under current law. Robert Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, who was previously the chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and Budget Committee, joins us to discuss how the white working class bought into Trump's right-wing narrative that the downsizing and loss of jobs in the Rust Belt is a result of the influx of immigrants, government regulations, and unions, and that once those enemies are defeated, good jobs will return to the industrial heartland. Then we look into Saturday's celebration in Washington by white nationalists of the alt-right basking in Donald Trump's victory, which they see as the first step towards a white ethno-state in North America. Adele Stan, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers the intersection of religion and politics and is a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, joins us to discuss the event's press conference at which Richard Spencer, the head of a white nationalist think tank, prevented journalists from taking pictures of the attendees while claiming that the alt-right is going to change the world. Then finally, we'll examine the record of the man praised by the alt-right's Spencer, who is thrilled by the prospect that in the Trump administration, Jeff Sessions will, quote, be at such a high level is a wonderful thing in terms of not prosecuting federal diversity and fair housing. Garrett Epps, a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, joins us to discuss his article at The Atlantic, The Signal Sent by Picking Jeff Sessions for Attorney General, and why this reflects the brazen nature of the racist and divisive campaign Donald Trump ran, which is now placing a remnant of the old South in charge of enforcing our laws and protecting our rights. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and previously was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
It's my pleasure.
And Robert, seems like a cruel irony that in the context of what I just was talking about, how the white working class seemed to buy into Trump's and the Republicans' narrative that the Rust Belt as a result and the downsizing as a result of immigrants, government regulations and unions, and once you get them out of the way, jobs will return. But one of the first things on the agenda of the new Republican House is to repeal early next year Obama's overtime rule that requires companies to pay time and a half to employees who make under $47,000. And that rule's set to go into effect on December the 1st. And that's the top priority, apparently, of House Republicans. So therein lies a, as I say, a kind of cruel irony.
Yeah, there's quite a contradiction here. Now, I would be mindful that the white working class that you referred to bought into something that Trump said. But if you actually go read his speeches or watch the videos, what he said was the system is rigged, the system is broken, and nobody's paid attention to you. And I think all of that is quite accurate. The diagnosis of these people being ignored, these people having severe health problems in comparison with other Americans, and the structures around privatization, deregulation, budget austerity, and banking and housing collapse that we saw in the end of the Bush and the beginning of the Obama administration are all testament to actual suffering. But there's a difference between a diagnosis and a prescribed remedy. And the prescribed remedy, now taking on what you might call traditional neoliberal Republican form, is a huge contradiction. And here I wonder how these people will say the system is rigged, we got to drain the swamp, when they see all the new alligators who are inhabiting the swamp. This is a very, very profound time for Trump, either losing the trust of the people who at the margin put him over the top, or stepping up to meet the challenge that he identified in order to inspire them.
So the division here then is, or the contradiction then is, we know what the House and the Senate are up to in Republican control. They've made it very clear. But we don't know what Trump is up to, right? That's the mystery. Whether he is indeed a populist and believes, in other words, is he just a showman, a huckster, which is what the charge that many leveled at him, and there's a good deal of evidence to suggest that he's always been a salesman and a huckster, or does he have core beliefs as expressed in these populist outbursts which people cling to and really want enacted? So I guess, what's your sense? We don't know. Do you know?
Well, you know, at some level, because of his own financial independence, he says, I used to play the rig system. I played it, and I played it well. And then the old adage, it takes a thief to catch a thief, he could diagnose how the system is rigged, and therefore, because of his wealth, call it out and step aside from it. But now he has to deal with the legislature, with the lobbying system, and with all kinds of people around him, from the Republican regulars and foreign policy establishment and so forth, who have been a very deep part of that. As a matter of fact, they've often been a part that made it intractable for Obama to alleviate some of those pains of the white working class that we've discussed here briefly. So I think he faces a tremendous contradiction, and the question is, will he take on the power structure of the Republican Party in governing, like he did in the primary season, as essentially the P.T. Barnum of American politics, as a very powerful persuader? But will he now dig in his heels and say that Donald Trump's greatness as a president will depend upon delivering the remedies? And that's a daunting and a formidable task, and we don't know whether he even aspires to it. But if he is going to be considered a great president, he has to embrace those challenges. And otherwise, it's essentially a seduce and abandon operation, and those people should be then not only disappointed and bitter, but then vote he and his party out of office rather quickly.
So in the macroeconomic sense, though, we seem to be, there's almost due for a recession. The economist, Nobel economist Paul Krugman's arguing that Donald Trump may give the economy a bit of a boost initially, but then start to sort of, it may start to collapse. I don't know whether they're going to go after the Fed and try and raise interest rates, which of course would accelerate the demise. What's your sense, just in give us a sense of the macroeconomic landscape, that this challenge that you've laid out very clearly that Trump faces, is he a phony or is he for real? If he's for real, he's really going to have to deliver on these populist promises, because the Republican House and Senate that he helped elect doesn't want any part of it.
Yeah, just by way of background, you mentioned my work on Capitol Hill. I worked for the Republican Senate Budget Committee under Pete Domenici, and then under the Democratic Senate Banking Committee under Bill Proxmire. And people I know from the budget process on the Republican side have been telling me for 8 years that Mitch McConnell was leading the charge to say that Obama, under no circumstances, in light of the financial crisis, will ever be the next Franklin D. Roosevelt. In that context, Obama was frustrated, but now the Republicans, for the first time, have essentially both body legislature and the White House in their own hands. My sense is that they were saying, let's have a Republican New Deal when we get power, though there are always budget cutters in both parties or people who worship fiscal austerity. But at this juncture, I would imagine them resisting the Federal Reserve raising interest rates quite vocally, talking about that there is a great deal of elasticity, in other words, ability for the economy to grow without being inflationary, as labor is reallocated, as the capital stock is modernized, as people become more productive and learning by doing, and people who are working part-time work full-time. And they will argue very fiercely from the White House and the administration with the Fed over these coming months, in my view. The thing that I would watch most closely is the composition of the fiscal stimulus that they do. I've seen rough documents and reports of very big tax cuts for the upper income people. Those people save a lot, so you're not getting a lot of bang for the deficit dollar from doing that. You're awarding the already wealthy and powerful, which looks more like crony capitalism. On the spending side, they talk about infrastructure. I wouldn't be surprised if places like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina were, what I call, disproportionately rewarded, so that those people in those swing states that crossed over do feel some progress. I anticipate that the fiscal stimulus and the pressure not to tighten monetary policy will elevate the growth rate and elevate activity for 2 to 3 years. And at some level, the inability, partly because of the Republican Party, of the Democrats to do this during the last 8 years is part of why we're in the problem, meeting, you know, the challenge, and why Trump proved to be attractive.
Well, clearly, it's kind of pointless to go over that territory, but there's no question that had Obama right out of the gate had a much more massive stimulus program when money is so cheap. But instead, his priority was the Affordable Care Act, which has actually ended up alienating a lot of middle-class people. Mm-hmm. So that's unfortunate. And of course, the point, I think the ultimate point, when you think about Eisenhower and the building the highways under the rubric of national security, a president who does rebuild America's infrastructure is going to be a very popular president. But again, Krugman and others are saying, you know, look at his stimulus plan. It's really crony capitalism. It's not a real stimulus plan. Do you think the Democrats can triangulate a little bit and get something better?
It'll be interesting to see if Trump himself differs somewhat from what Congress is producing and reaches to people like Chuck Schumer to try and triangulate and modify that program in the spirit of compromise. I don't know whether he'll do that or whether he'll just play a hard line all the way down with Republican Party, but I think if they go with what Krugman and others call a crony capitalism plan, Trump's own reputation will suffer markedly.
So what then is the, I mean, we know, for example, that the vice president is essentially in the pocket of the Koch brothers, the new head of the CIA is. We know that that Paul Ryan, I mean, I don't know whether you noticed Rob Johnson, Paul Ryan's victory speech after the election, where he largely congratulated Donald Trump and the coattails, but just basically said, you know, we can't wait to cut down the forests, pollute the waters, bring back coal. I mean, it was like the Koch brothers' wish list. So that's where I see the contradictions. And frankly, I don't quite know what to expect.
I'm a little bit concerned about that interpretation. You talked about the white working class. Mm-hmm. If their wages don't go up, if their employment doesn't go up, they will feel abandoned. If they see shenanigans, what we might call crony capitalism taking place, windfalls for the wealthy, they will be disheartened. But on climate, which I personally think is very necessary to make very substantial progress, a lot of people in America, when you survey them, say that climate is a luxury in relation to their employment insecurity, and that their dread that massive changes in employment will accompany and dislocations in employment will accompany any attempt to embrace climate change. So there's a hesitance there, and I can imagine people coming out on both sides of that, even in the long run, where we need climate change and where we might call a vigorous energy transformation program, both on the side of conservation and on the side of producing new sources of non-carbon related energy could be a big boost to employment and economic activity.
But promising to bring back coal is an empty promise. I mean, it's Wall Street and has abandoned coal, has it not? And
well,
natural gas is so cheap.
Solar and the developments in wind power and the low price of natural gas, coal is almost uncompetitively priced out of the market at this point.
Right.
It doesn't even require social policy.
Right. So that's the reality. But again, you know, you wonder about the gap between the promises and the reality here, and how that relates to these people that you have suggested may be seduced and abandoned. If they're not, then I think Donald Trump could be an incredibly successful president.
Yes, I dread to think about it, but if he stumbles in some regards, we go back to what you might call the old recipe book of Bismarck in Germany, which is go declare war and unify the country around an external enemy. And as you mentioned a few moments ago, the hawkish character of almost all of the foreign policy team suggests a very aggressive posture in terms of national defense.
But when we talk about this, having bought the white working class, having bought this conservative right-wing narrative, the blaming the immigrants, government regulations and unions for the downsizing and the Rust Belt, and once those enemies are defeated, the good jobs will return. On the other hand, the Democratic narrative is just sort of, you know, techno babble about, oh, you know, it's the industrial, the information age taking over from the industrial age. Why isn't there any kind of coherent narrative from the Democrats, particularly the corporate Democrats? And we suffer. I mean, they suffered from that in this election. Losing the Rust Belt ought to be a wake up call that something's wrong when the Democratic Party has lost America's working class.
Yes, but both parties, with the exception of extremely wealthy self-financing candidates, are the prisoner of the need to raise money in politics, the need to raise almost $1 billion to be the president of the United States. So if you have to court the fundraisers, which are disproportionately what they call the 1%, and large corporations, then you're not going to talk authentically about the suffering of the working class, because some of those policies, that rebalancing, contradicts what the fundraisers want. And the Democratic Party was, at the time when I worked on the Hill, they founded what's called the Democratic Leadership Council. I call it almost as a defensive maneuver, because they were afraid Ronald Reagan had found a recipe where all the money was going to dry up on the Democratic side and the Republicans would rule forever. But as that's played out, and as the scale of money in politics has exploded, particularly in the aftermath of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, the Democrats have become more and more conflicted and mute and what you might call subject to or promulgating what you called technobabble, and they haven't made a lot of sense, and people can smell it.
Well, but does that explain then Trump's success? In other words, he's not beholden to the extent that the regular Democrats and Republicans are, and was able to then speak truth to the working class. A question, of course, looming whether or not this was just campaign rhetoric or actual something that he actually believes in.
I was in Michigan the week of the election, which is where I grew up, and I found people, both suburban and urban, black and white, Democrat and Republican, that found Trump refreshing. Trump went to the Economic Club of Detroit right after the Republican convention. That's where he started. And he actually took on the auto companies. He didn't beat up the working man. He didn't talk about laziness or disparage black people. He took on the corporations for moving their plants out of the country. And all of that energy is what you might call subject matter that struck home with these people and had been missing from the dialogue in either party. Both parties in America adopted what you might call identity politics agenda. There was a dispute between Democrats and Republicans over women's reproductive rights. African Americans were disproportionately in the Democratic Party. The LGBTQ community was disproportionately in the Democratic Party. The Christian churches were disproportionately in the Republican Party. And they all fought over these very important aspects of life and freedom and rights. But meanwhile, the plutocrats in both parties carried on above them. And as they carried on, the economic issues were addressed, what you might say, to the detriment of a large portion of American population. The median income in 13 swing states was measured by the Wall Street Journal from the day Obama came into office to just on the eve of the election. In 11 of the 13 states that were called the swing states, it was down. One, it was flat, and one was up marginally. And that's where this election was decided.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Rob Johnson. We will stay tuned to see whether your prophecy, I guess, that the white working class may have been seduced and abandoned, or on the other hand, if he comes through, Trump comes through and fulfills his promises, he may well be a successful president.
Well, we have a big problem for a Democratic administration that the Senate has 24 Democrats, if you include Bernie Sanders, and only 10 Republicans up for re-election in 2 years. So it tends to indicate the Republicans will fortify their strength of control of Congress at that time.
Well, Rob Johnson, I thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who's the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and previously was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a Saturday celebration in Washington, D.C. by white nationalists of the alt-right basking in Donald Trump's victory.
There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be.
Me at the bottom don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working bands. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul. Tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adele Stand, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She is currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, where she has an article, A Government of, By, and For the Deplorables. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stand.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Adele, you were at the press conference at the gathering on Saturday of the National Policy Institute, a white nationalist think tank, and it was a pretty strange press conference held by the president of the National Policy Institute, Richard Spencer, who supposedly coined the term alt-right, and he's a proponent of white identity, but as journalists, you were not allowed to photograph the people who were attending, right?
To protect. Yes, that's how he started out giving us ground rules, and characterized the people attending his conference in heroic terms, saying they had taken great risk to come there, risking even their livelihoods, getting death threats. So we were not to to show them. So already, he's kind of setting up that classic right-wing thing where they claim victimization,
Right. Well, I remember Rush Limbaugh's brother wrote a book about how Christians are oppressed, evangelical yes. Christians in this country.
They will tell you that constantly. I mean, go to any of their right. events. That is a big, a big part of their...
Right. And gun owners, too. Have you noticed that? That gun owners in America are oppressed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The whining is just unbelievable, right?
Are these suit and tie Nazis? I mean, what's going on here? What does it look like?
Well, what it looks like is it does look neo-Nazi. Now, I mean, Spencer is very clever. He is also mediagenic. And for those two reasons, he's dangerous. I mean, I think, he's clearly has sociopathic tendencies. They weren't awarding credentials to anybody who asked for them for the whole conference. Some reporters did make arrangements with MPI that allowed them to stay for the length of the duration of the conference. But most of the media who were there, as I was, were at a press conference in the middle of the day that ran about an hour and 45 minutes, I'd say. So we got the very mediagenic version of Richard Spencer. He had arrayed on the stage leaders of other alt-right organizations or websites, including Peter Brimelow of VDare and Jared Taylor of American Renaissance. But he barely allowed them to speak. I mean, he was hogging the...
Right. And that's Brimelow, a British guy, right?
Yes, he is. Uh-huh. I couldn't tell whether he was, he sounds like he may be Scottish. I don't know. But yes, he is British. And
the movement's international. That's you've got Le Pen, you've got Orban in Hungary, Farage, who is also Trump's buddy. But why did they go along with a self-defined term like alt-right? Why can't we call them what they are, white nationalist neo-Nazis?
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. And there was a very interesting exchange with a journalist from NPR, National Public Radio, who I believe was probably a producer. I did not recognize his name, where he tried to engage Spencer on that question of, wasn't he really just rebranding, white supremacy? And Spencer became quite irritated with the journalist and eventually just shut down the conversation.
So is it true that at the end of this celebration of the Trump victory, on stage they shouted Heil Victory, like Heil Hitler, but instead Heil Victory?
I don't know. I wasn't there. I wasn't there at that point in time. I had gone to the presser. I had, not applied to... I had asked for credentials for the whole conference, but they never responded.
Right.
But the New York Times account is quite clear of, the Hail Trump stuff and the Nazi salutes, and there's been a video shot by a journalist from the Atlantic of that going around. And Spencer spoke in German at one point, I believe, and according to the New York Times account, and referred to, invoked the Nazi term, Lügenpresse.
The lying press.
Yeah, the lying press.
Mm. What is this fascination with Germany? I mean, I guess it sort of tips the hand, does it not?
Yeah, no, they're not pulling any punches. And, the books, you talked about the international nature of the movement. A guy named Alain Benoit, his tomes were quite popular. There was a poster. They're big on Nietzsche, very big on Nietzsche. Yeah, so they're very, yeah, they definitely are a Deutsche Files of a sort.
But what's the Trump connection? I mean, any wacko can say that we're supporting Trump and he's our guy and we're now empowered by him. I think there's probably more members of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Avakian's disciples, than there are members of the KKK. I mean, these are very fringe groups we're talking about here.
They are.
So
they are not, but they are dangerous.
Uh-huh. Well, that's true, they've done some hideous stuff in the past, and they would probably do it in the future if they were allowed. And I guess that's the problem here. How much is the Stephen Bannons of the world sitting in Karl Rove's old office right across from the Oval Office?
In the West Wing, right.
What's he doing? Is he going to empower these people or disavow them? He hasn't disavowed them so far.
I would say he has already empowered them. And they're very interested. You know, they are very clear that they do not regard Bannon himself as alt-right, but as somebody who saw in the alt-right an opportunity and one that he leveraged both for Breitbart and for advancing the Trump campaign. They do not consider Trump himself to be alt-right, but they see that Trump has used them and that they can use Trump. And they feel a certain, mutual... Their fortunes, are enhanced by a mutual action. So what you have is with Bannon clearly has connections to the alt-right. Mike Flynn, who was named a national security advisor, a position that does not have to be confirmed by the Senate, and a very powerful one, has tweeted laudatory descriptions of a book written by one of the primary meme makers of the alt-right, a guy named Cernovich. If you want to go old school, I mean, what's with Sessions going soft on the KKK, saying, that he thought they were okay, except that they smoked pot? Senator Jeff Sessions, who's been, nominated for Attorney General.
Well, but it's Spencer. Apparently this was in the press conference. Spencer went out of his way to praise the choice of Jeff Sessions. I'm
That's
quoting
right.
Spencer. The fact
and
that he is
Mike Flynn, yes.
Yeah, this is quoting Spencer. The fact that he is going to be such at a high level, talking about Sessions, such at a high level is a wonderful thing. What Jeff Sessions is going to do in terms of not prosecuting federal diversity and fair housing, I think, is just as powerful as what he might do. So that is extraordinary that they get it. I mean, I'm sure in the Senate hearing, and we're going to be talking about the Sessions in a moment, or the choice of Sessions. I'm sure in the confirmation hearing, at least the Democrats are going to bring up some of the seedy stuff in Sessions' past. But I'm sure the Republicans will come to his defense and say, "Oh, that was ancient history, and he's no longer that person." I mean, if you got Spencer saying, "Isn't this great?" Maybe they know something.
I think they do, and I think they've made a very shrewd analysis of how their movement functioned in Trump's favor during the Trump campaign and how the Trump campaign used them. I think they're very clear on that. And why I say they're dangerous, it's not simply the individual harassment, executed by their individual members. It's because Spencer himself is a charismatic figure. He draws media attention. We don't know we're always wrestling with that question of, well, he's a phenomenon. Do we, is there any way to cover him without feeding the movement? That's a whole, thing that we're a lot of journalists are trying to wrestle with right now. However, because he's mediagenic and because he draws media attention, there's that gives him the bandwidth and the microphone to poison the well with tropes, with the anti-Semitic tropes, with anti-black tropes, with misogyny. He now has the platform to further influence people who would never join a neo-Nazi group, but who will accept as fact these kinds of implications, the old stereotypes about Jews and women and anybody who's not a white male.
Well, Adele, thank you for joining us. We're going to move on now and talk about Jeff Sessions. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. She's currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, where she has an article, A Government of, By, and For the Deplorables. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Donald Trump has placed a remnant of the old South in charge of enforcing our laws and protecting our rights.
You've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in their game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Garrett Epps, a contributing writer to The Atlantic and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court, and he has an article at The Atlantic, The Signal Sent by Picking Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Epps.
Great to be here.
And Garrett, in terms of a signal, let's just start with a quick sketch of Senator Sessions' voting record, which I think tells you a lot. He led the opposition to the bipartisan effort in 2016 to ease sentencing guidelines for nonviolent offenders. He co-sponsored the Local Zoning Decisions Protection Act, which prohibited the use of federal funds to implement fair housing. He voted against the confirmation of Justice Sotomayor and called Justice Sotomayor unsuitable for the bench due to her past affiliation with civil rights organizations, voted against the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, voted against the Matthew Shepard Hate Crimes Prevention Act, voted against the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, voted against reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, opposed President Obama's 2012 executive action on undocumented immigrants, DACA, and described the Voting Rights Act as a piece of intrusive legislation. So disregarding what the media is playing, the 1981 confirmations before the Senate where he was rejected as a federal judge, his recent record that I've just read is just appalling.
Well, this is the face of the old South that has learned nothing and forgotten nothing in the half century since the Civil Rights Movement. Sessions has indicated by his record, by his words, by how he has conducted himself on the Judiciary Committee that he wants us back there in the 1950s at the time of states' rights when there was minimal civil rights protection against racial discrimination and sex roles were the way they were back in the 1950s. It is an extraordinary record. In other words, there are a lot of very conservative lawyers from whom Mr. Trump could have selected an attorney general. This is among the most extreme, and it it sends this signal, right? We are going to make America great again, which means we are going back 50 years. We are going back 60 years. I was just stunned by it, and I don't consider myself naive about Donald Trump.
But the Department of Justice has more than 110,000 employees and a budget of $27 billion, as you point out in your article. And it is also, the Attorney General's the head of the Bureau of Prisons. He's in charge of the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Enforcement. He's the leader of the Department's Civil Rights Division. I mean, let's start there. I mean, how are you going to have somebody that's been a lifelong an opponent of civil rights defending the civil rights? That's, I think, where the signal really is. Like, this is not so much turning back the clock. This is smashing the clock.
Well, we've seen what to, we know what to expect in the guidance of the Civil Rights Division, Ian, because we saw it under the George W. Bush administration, where a group of conservative ideologues came in and announced that the priority was going to be protecting white people against discrimination, that was the true problem. And I think we can confidently expect to see that same sort of emphasis put on the Civil Rights Division. It's, you know, disturbing because in America, 2016, as you know as well as I do, we have tremendous problems involving communities and police and race and justice. And the Justice Department has played a very constructive role in a lot of those situations. We rely on the U.S. Justice Department to come into situations involving police and allegations of undue force and investigate, and in the cases where federal civil rights laws have been broken, to prosecute, even to prosecute law enforcement. I don't think we really need to look forward to a lot of such prosecutions over the next 4 years if Sessions becomes Attorney General. I think he will be much more concerned with protecting law enforcement and protecting white privilege than the Civil Rights Division has been for the past 8 years.
So it's worth having the audience just think back of what's happened in the last couple of years in terms of police abuse and subsequent race relations and tensions that they have created. Ferguson being a good example. I mean, the Justice Department intervention there in Ferguson has changed the police department. It has stopped them from this kind of debtor's prison system they had of, you know, of speed traps, et cetera, just to raise revenues for a city at the expense of its own citizens, et cetera. That stuff's going to be all out the window. It's going to be defending racist police departments.
I would assume that the emphasis of the department will no longer be on coming into communities that are really split this way, that they're going to be much more involved in trying to empower and support local police, regardless of the facts underlying it. And as you note, you know, the Justice Department has historically had a tremendous role in coming into situations like this and not just punishing someone who has done something wrong, but negotiating with the local governments and local police. You know, here's how we're going to move forward. Here we, from outside, we see these problems, and let's analyze how we move forward. This is a very important service that the DOJ has been offering since the civil rights era, and if the practice is abandoned or neglected, the consequences could be very negative.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary, you know, that Donald Trump didn't even hire somebody that was more presentable, perhaps harbored these sort of views privately. One of the things that I detected about this election, about this current administration, is that in many ways it seemed that Donald Trump was able to go out there on the stump and say stuff that nobody would say, particularly in polite circles, but perhaps a lot of right-wing people in this country say in private, including Republicans. So to that extent, he kind of riled up the country in a kind of racist frenzy and ecstasy of anger and got the party over the top by literally pushing the envelope on racist speech, hate speech, etc. I mean, it's almost like it's all been forgotten. Didn't anybody notice that this was not your regular campaign?
Well, you know, this was some of the media people, some of the major media, called this out. And one of the answers that Trump's supporters would often give were, you know, that he's not politically correct. He says it, calls him the way he sees him, but he said, I'm the least racist person you know. Since he has become president, he has very insistently signaled that the core of his administration is a kind of white supremacy, white nationalism, ethnocentrism. He is, you know, staffing his national security operation with people who are blanket hostile to Islam. You know, he has Steve Bannon, who is, you know, an outright white nationalist, as his number one counselor in the White House, and now Sessions, who not only, you know, is a very dedicated and, it has to be say, effective enemy of civil rights and of general protection against discrimination, but who also sends that message. You know, that message is, yes, we know that even in the height of the Reagan era, the Senate could not swallow this man as a judge because of his record. Hmm. Even so, we're now going to make him attorney general, and you can't stop us.
Right, and it was a Republican-dominated, the Republicans controlled the Senate at the time of those hearings. So it was a Republican Judiciary Committee that rejected him.
Yes, that's right, and he was one of only about two nominees rejected by the committee during that period of time. It was quite an extraordinary thing for that to happen, and particularly for it to happen on that issue, because as you know, the Reagan administration was not distinguished by its forward thrust on civil rights. A number of people who were quite conservative on racial issues, who opposed affirmative action and so forth, were named to various posts and received confirmation. But this was just a bridge too far, even for Republicans. And to go back now and say, America, you're crossing this bridge, it's shocking.
And again, I'm speaking with Garrett Epps, who's a contributing writer to The Atlantic and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court, and he has an article at The Atlantic, The Signal Sent by Picking Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. But Garrett, when you say Donald Trump, and he has said it, I know, that he's not racist, and he had a photo op the other day with the prize fighter Floyd Mayweather. So I guess that means he's not racist, right?
Of course.
but if you deliberately, when you announce your presidency, you go out of your way to insult Latinos, it wasn't as if it was a slip of the tongue. It was a deliberate statement where he said that, talked about Mexicans being rapists and murderers. And that's how he started his campaign out. Now, I think it's worse to do something deliberately and strategically as opposed to being a racist and letting it all hang out. I mean, this was a cynical use of racism, and that set the tone and the strategy for his election, which was, as I think you have to remind the American people, that this guy ran an explicitly racist campaign.
Well, you know, this is something, again, that comes to me from my youth in the American South, growing up in the years before the Civil Rights Movement. There used to be a strategy that we called white man's candidate, and you could signal to the electorate that you were always going to stand with white people, you were always going to stand with white supremacy, regardless of the issue, and it could be, you know, it sometimes could be done overtly, but it can also be done by signals. And I think we've seen Trump become the white man's candidate and almost say explicitly, you know, I'm here to defend the interests of a certain embattled group of white people, and I'm appealing to white solidarity. And he has used, as you noted, the explicitly racist language about Mexicans. He has spoken in incredibly disparaging terms about African Americans. He has threatened Muslims, you know, with all kinds of horrible things, including potentially having relatives of terrorist suspects arrested or even executed. Just go down the list and see the way he has talked about groups that are not, you know, what a certain, you know, the certain group of white people consider to be American. It wasn't subtle. These aren't even dog whistles, right? These are just sort of cries to the dogs.
But what underlies that? What is the point of Breitbart and Bannon and those people who are so sort of snide in their rejection of what they call political correctness? That there's an absolutely no concept that this speech is hurtful to people, particularly to children. You know, the idea that you want, as a white American, you feel the need to assert your right to crush the hopes and dreams of young minority Americans by insulting them and their race. What motivates that? I don't understand these people. They're riding high, they're cocky, they're full of contempt. We won, you lost. That's their attitude. But can you figure this out, this kind of thinking? It seems like the worst of the kind of nasty, privileged, entitled fraternity boy bad behavior.
Well, I mean, I think that's exactly what it is, and I think what you have to unpack this term political correctness, Ian, and what it really means at its core, and is something that these people do find very disturbing. They find it very threatening, and that is that ways that they were able to talk about certain groups of people, ways they were able to talk about women in the past, are no longer being tolerated. Those groups are saying, you have to stop calling us by these nicknames. You have to stop describing us by these stereotypes. You have to stop talking about women as fat pigs and sluts and all of the terms that you know were affixed to them. And a lot of white men perceive this as a loss. They perceive this as things being taken from them, as they're being, you know, I've read extensive stuff on the web about how white men are silenced in our culture, meaning that because they can't say what they want to say the way they say it, that they're now the oppressed group. And I think on top of that, you know, when you look at somebody like Bannon and you look at these Islamophobes, you see simple, straight out racism. It never went away. I don't think anybody even really felt it went away. We thought we were battling it. We thought we had the law on our side. We thought we had the government on our side. We thought it was generally agreed in this society that that was the goal. And this has been an enormous change in our culture.
Well, but now the government and the law is on their side. That's what's
Absolutely.
So alarming about Bannon, and more to the point, Jeff Sessions as the Attorney General. He is the number one lawman in the country. He's the one who upholds the Constitution and enforces and the whole idea is to protect minorities, you know, not tyrannize the minority.
I mean, well, the most important thing to know about Jeff Sessions' career is the investigation he conducted in the 1980s in which he attempted to imprison civil rights advocates in Alabama because they were registering black people to vote and helping them vote absentee. And this is the case of the Marion Three, including, you know, Albert Turner, who had been, you know, closely involved with Dr. Martin Luther King, who was a very famous civil rights advocate, and his wife and another African-American activist who were arrested. He dragged 90-year-old African-Americans who were trying to vote for the first time, he dragged them before a federal grand jury, which is probably the most frightening experience that someone can have with the American government. You have to appear with no counsel. You're not explained why you're there. You know, a 93-year-old man is being called in front of this and asked why he registered to vote. This is what Sessions does when he has power. And he will now be the most powerful person in the legal system, in many ways more powerful than any judge.
And that happened in January of 1985, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, a 39-year-old U.S. attorney from the Southern District of Alabama, basically terrorized elderly African-Americans for exercising their right to vote. It's not a good omen, is it?
No, I think you're going to see investigations, you're going to see prosecutions of civil rights advocates who try to get involved with voter registration and prevent vote suppression, and it's very ominous.
Well, but he's already said that the Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor shouldn't be on the Supreme Court. He voted against her because she mm-hmm. worked in civil rights. I mean, I thought that was a kind of badge of honor to be an American who wants to improve, you know, the life of all Americans and move the country forward as opposed to backwards.
Well, remember when he was brought before the committee for his nomination, one of the things that he didn't deny, and he in fact confirmed, is that he had referred to the NAACP and the American Civil Liberties Union as pinko un-American organizations. He tried to say that it was a joke, but he didn't say it. And if you study his conduct looking at judicial nominations on the Judiciary Committee, not just Supreme Court nominations, but, you know, the day-in, day-out district judge, court of appeals, any time a nominee has been involved with the NAACP, any time a nominee has been involved with the ACLU, any time a nominee has been involved with a Latino organization or a women's rights organization or Planned Parenthood, he has attempted to block the nomination on the grounds that there's something un-American about this activity. He gets called on it, or he would get called on it frequently and then back off. But it is very much the kind of McCarthy, not just guilt by association, but guilt by smear, because these organizations are mainstream civil rights and civil liberties organizations. They're very important to the way that our system works. And to take the position that they are outside the mainstream and that those who cooperate with them are somehow suspect is way out on the right fringe.
Well, Garrett Epps, I thank you for joining us. I know that some of these questions, at least I hope the Democrats will ask in the confirmation, but I'm equally sure that the Republicans will all come to his defense, just as they did when they gutted the Voting Rights Act, saying, oh, we don't need it anymore. You know, it's all changed. It's all healed. And Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is a different person today. I mean, that's almost predictable, isn't it?
I think so. I think they're going to say he's learned his lesson. He's not racist. Here is, you know, this witness who's black who'll say, you know, he never said anything bad to me. But I think if you look at the man's entire record, and as I say, I'm from the American South myself, you can tell how someone acts, a white person acts, if they've really realized what Southern racism was like and have accepted that they have a role in helping to bring it down. It's not like Sessions. He has never shown the slightest awareness that this system was unjust and that systematic racial discrimination is wrong, unconstitutional, and un-American.
Well, Garrett Epps, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Enjoyed it.
I did too, and although I'm not enjoying this situation at all, and again, I've been speaking with Garrett Epps, a contributing writer for The Atlantic, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court, and he has an article at The Atlantic, The Signal Sent by Picking Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.